Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peep State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peep State Pandemonium.
Good evening. Welcome to Peep State Pandemonium for July 12, 2012. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by my legendary co-host, the Georgia gentleman, Jerry Oates, and the pride of Jackson, Georgia, Mr. Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
We're doing good. I'm glad all of us are here tonight.
Yeah, doing wonderful. Glad to be back.
I'm glad we're all together, too, so we're have a good show tonight. I picked a subject. I don't think we've talked about this before, but we've talked about it so much, we may have. I decided we'd take a look at wrestling families, both real and actually related, and those that were made up for the wrestling world. I hope that'd be a good subject to talk about since
You mean some of these guys that said they were brothers weren't brothers? See, I really had my thoughts about Ted and Jerry. I mean, Ted and Jerry were totally opposite in personality. And so I've often wondered.
Not to mention height.
Oh, my gosh. Ted, don't get that started.
I was fixing to say that was a touchy subject, wasn't it?
But let me tell you, but he showed up for Ron's funeral, you know, and I really respect him for that. And a lot of people knew I had a brother, and he introduced himself to a couple of people, and he said, "And I'm the short one." I couldn't believe he said that.
I love it.
Because they always would ask me, "You the tall one or the short one?"
I love it.
At least
Mr. High and Mr. Low.
We did get a laugh.
So he more than made up for the talent, though. I'll say that.
He did do that, brother. Of course, you know, Ted wasn't that short. I mean, you know, I was just taller than him, that's all.
No, I was just saying, just compared to you, what are you, 6'3"?
6'3".
Yeah. And he's probably what? 5'10", 5'11", somewhere in there?
He's 5'11".
Yeah, I was going to say, he's not that, just compared to you.
I was always on the leaner side, and Ted was always thicker than I was, you know, and it just made him probably look shorter than what he was. He wasn't that short. I'll tell y'all a story. One time we flown back out to Kansas City to a tournament. We wound up in the tournament. I think I told the story. The last four in the tournament was me, and it was Ted and myself against Brody and Ernie Ladd. And Brody looked at Ted, and he said, "I don't wrestle midgets." Ted didn't appreciate that too much. That's really me, huh? You're talking about wrestling families. I always heard that Bobby and Charlie were some kind of how related.
We are. Rumor. We branch kin.
The way he talks, I think Charlie's related to 3/4 of the people in the state of Georgia.
And he may be.
He could very well be.
Well, that's not beyond the realm of possibility.
No, it is not, sir.
And you know, there's a lot of folks in Tennessee look a lot like Joe Turner. I've been told too.
I don't doubt that either, sir. They're all selling rugs up there. I heard.
He's in the sunglasses. Well, he's still doing the carpets and linens and stuff. But he's now doing hats and sunglasses.
Well, that's good to be versatile.
He'll be the sunglass king of Mobile County before it's over with. He'll corner the market down there. Oh, man.
Bobby's been hot in Jackson.
Yeah, it's been very hot in Jackson. Today was the first day in, I think they said 15 or 16 days, it didn't make 90. It got to like 88, 89 today.
It cooled off.
Yeah, we're in a cool spell.
You broken out your windbreaker yet?
Oh, geez. I mean, it's a the company I work for. Of course, I'm downtown, and you know, we're in an office building downtown, and it's very comfortable there. But we have a fulfillment warehouse out in Decatur, and it's exactly that. It's a big warehouse. They've got those big exhaust fans, but it's not air conditioned. I went out there one day when it was clipping 102 and 103 outside. Inside that building, it was 94 degrees.
My gosh.
And then poor guys out there running around on them forklifts and working. I mean, I don't know how they stand it.
Well, what do they sell where you work, Bobby?
We're owned by the company that owns us is called R.R. Donnelly. They're a printing conglomerate. I mean, they got printing plants all over the world. They got like 18 different printing plants. They got one in China and one in Poland and several here in the United States and different places. And the company that I actually work for, we're a design firm. We're the people that actually do I'm the only person there that's not creative. I'm the facility manager and the expediter that gets the stuff moved around. But we're the place, we got about 80 employees, and of the 80, 70 of them are creators. They actually get on the computer and create different things. You know, when you come to us with an idea or you have a concept you want to put down on paper, we create your logo. We do all the menu boards for Chick-fil-A for every store in the country. We do. There's a chain of restaurants over in Alabama called Jack's. We do all of their menu boards. When Delta repainted their airlines, their planes here a few years ago, we helped come up with some of the color schemes for their airlines, so their planes. So
Bobby, you always created havoc.
And I still do. Yeah, I mean, you know, you find your niche in life that you're good at, you just keep going.
You just go with it, that's right.
Oh. Is it crowded down there, Jerry? You got a lot of tourists?
Bobby, you wouldn't believe it.
Oh.
You would not believe how crazy people can get. You know what people are doing right now? They come to the beach and find out they can't take their pets on the beach. They go lock their dogs in the car with the windows rolled up.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, sir. Oh, that's big. Oh, that. Oh my.
I should say. I hope you throw them in jail.
They get that's a $1,000 fine. Cruelty to an animal.
Oh, I just that's.
Oh, I get so mad I can't hardly see straight.
We got two cats that live with us, but they don't know they're cats.
That's right.
They think they're human beings with fur bodies.
How could you do an animal like that? Animals are so helpless. You know they.
Yeah, that's. I can't imagine.
It doesn't make sense whatsoever.
You know, within like 20 minutes, a car inside, you know, in the summertime, gets like 140 degrees.
Oh, yeah, it's like putting them in the microwave.
That's the same thing, exactly.
Yeah. Oh.
It's crazy. Well, if you started your side position down there.
And what would that be, sir?
Aren't you, during the summertime, aren't you the official bikini checker? Don't you go along with the measuring?
I have to kind of watch that every now and then, yes.
Make sure that the bikinis are in regulation.
Yeah.
If not, I know a couple guys that would volunteer for that job and probably wouldn't ask for a salary.
It's bad on your eyes. I mean,
isn't your wife redheaded?
No, she's blonde.
She's blonde. I can just see that blonde hair as she's wailing on your body, flying in the wind if she caught you checking out bikinis.
I tell her when I ride the beach on those Arctic cats, I wear blinders.
I'm telling you. I had a little girl in a Sunday school class. This is many years ago. She's married and got kids of her own now. But she was about 15, you know, and just getting at that age where she was boy crazy. And something was said about something, and I said, "Well, I thought you were going steady with somebody." And she told me, she said, "Just because you're on a diet does not mean you can't look at the menu."
That's right.
So.
Yeah, I can imagine, Kathy, she'll come out of retirement, break out those skates, and do a double axel on your knob.
Oh, geez, can you imagine?
I see her sharpening those things every now and then. I wonder what that was about.
Woo. Goodness.
Except there won't be holiday on ice at your house.
Well, I kind of starting to resemble the butcher at my forehead now. I don't know what that's from.
Oh, man.
When I see her take those guards off of those blades, I know then I'm in trouble.
Before we go too much further, I don't know if you guys had ever heard of this gentleman. I know neither one of you ever had an opportunity to see him or work with him. A gentleman by the name of Dara Singh, who was the biggest wrestling star in history of India, was also a major film star over there and some sort of government official later on in life. He passed away, I think, this morning. He had a massive heart attack last week and was in bad condition for about a week. And then I think it was this morning he passed away. He was 83 years old. If you remember, Jerry Butcher mentioned him last week on the show that he wrestled him over in India and also made a couple movies with him over there.
Yeah, I remember. Did he ever come to the States?
I don't think he ever. There was a Singh, Size Tiger Jeet Singh, who was a big star in Canada and then around the Detroit and Buffalo area. There was a Singh that wrestled in Toronto. Was a major opponent of Whipper Watson's back in the 40s and 50s, and I don't know if that was Dara or not. I'll have to have a chance to research it, but I know Fez mentioned him in his book. He wrestled him in England as well as in India and was very close friends with him. Thought a lot of him, so evidently he, like I said, he was the biggest star that India ever had, even bigger than the great Gama. It was early in the 20th century that Dara Singh bypassed him as their biggest star. But I don't know if he ever came to the States or not.
I know he was a big star. I know the name very well.
I'm sure Dick probably would be familiar with him. Signboard, so I'm sure he probably
might have run across him somewhere.
Pass with in Europe somewhere or something when he was, because I'm sure he was active back in early in Dick's career in Europe. But anyway, wanted to pass that information along, and even though he wasn't a star here, he's still a member of the fraternity, and it just
that's
it hurts every time we lose one. I tell you. It hurts. But to roll on to our subject for tonight, wrestling families. And then starting with you got into the business because of a family connection with Steinborn. Was being related to him, did it make it any easier for you to get into the business or harder, do you think?
I think it made it harder. I know I approached him. Him and my sister they were up from Orlando one Christmas. This was in 1968, and they were here. And I approached him. You know, I got him off to the side. And I said, "Look, I said, you know, I want." Start wrestling, he said, really? And I think I've told his story, and he said, well, you know, that's a problem. You're here in Columbus and I'm in Orlando. How do you expect me to train you? And then he hit me with something that I couldn't give him an answer. to. He said, "What do you have to offer professional wrestling?" And I was stuck for an answer. I mean, what he said, you know, Briscoe had just started down in Florida. He said, "Can you beat Jack Briscoe?" I said, "Well, I doubt it. I'd never seen Jack, you know." And so about 6 months later, I moved to Orlando. And I got down there and found me a job and got set up. And so I was there about a month and a half, and I told him, I said, "When we can start training?" He said, "I'll let you know when I'm ready." That's what he was. And I think he just wanted to see if I really wanted to do it, you know. So I said, "Oh, yeah, sure, I'll teach you," you know.
Yeah.
So that went on for, I guess, about 6 months. And he called me one Sunday. He says, "I got the keys to the gym. Let's go." And we went from there. But, it wasn't just, "Oh, I want to start wrestling. Oh, great, I'll train you." It wasn't like that. I mean, I had to move 400 miles and sit around and wait and work out and wait till he got ready. I guess he was seeing if I was serious or not. You know, I don't know what other guys, I mean, of course, now today you can get in, just order you some boots and, well, order you some tennis shoes and you can get in.
I was going to say, yeah.
I overstepped my boundary there, probably.
Yeah, but you forgot where you were. I mean, I think this, you know, that's interesting, and you never went into it, and I don't know. I know I've never asked you. Tell me how he went about training you. How did he start you out? How did he? What's some of the things you had to do when you first started?
Started out on the mats, no ring, just mats, and he would show me how to, you know, hook up, lock up. You know, we did that for, you know, a while, and then he would show me how to go into a headlock from there. You know, one of the toughest things for me to get down, and when I was training guys, from a headlock to drop down, you know, you cross in front of a guy and to take the guy over your back.
Yeah.
That footwork right in there, it's after you get it, it's so simple. The guys had more trouble with that. And then, you know, we went from there and just, I know, we went back to work out and he said, "Okay," he said, "I'm going to give you a backdrop." Well, I knew what a backdrop was, but I didn't know, you know, the correct way to, I said, "Well, what I do?" You know what he told me? I'll never forget it. "Come running and you'll figure it out." But when I landed friend, I was in a mess. That's the way he was. And, you know, he didn't, I don't know how long we worked out. I mean, it wasn't as in-depth as you would think, but it was, I know when I trained guys, I took longer with them, like Jannetty. I spent a lot of time with him. And then, of course, you know, some guys wanted me to do it, and they couldn't have done it yet, you know. That it, you know, either you have it, whatever what it is, you know, some had it and some didn't. But it's, I don't know if you ever tried to train anybody, Bobby, or
no,
Mike.
I didn't.
No.
It's not what you think. And, you know, I always want to turn out guys because when they ask who trained them, you know, I didn't want to turn somebody out that, "Oh, yeah, Jerry Hill's training." Oh, really?
Well, that was another thing I was going to throw at you. You know, Dick probably, and I don't know if he ever said this or not, but you were ultimately going to be compared against him no matter what you did. No matter how you, when people found out you were his brother-in-law and he trained you, it didn't matter. I mean, this is a totally different scenario, but I umpired baseball and softball, Little League and up through adults for 23 years. And my son came to me when he was 15 and wanted to start umpiring, and I told him no. And, I mean, he was heartbroken. I mean, you'd have thought I'd shot him.
Exactly.
And I said, "You got to understand something. You got to mature a little bit." I said, "Because you're going to be a reflection of me." Now, I started him at 16, and he took to it like a duck took to water. He actually got better at it than I was, and he's calling high school baseball in Columbus right now. I mean, he's still doing it. But he just, you know, I mean, I told him, and it was one of the things that when I was teaching him how to do it, I said, look, I said, no matter how hard you do, how good you do, how bad you do, they're always going to say, well, that's Bobby's kid.
There you go. I mean, and that's the way it was when I trained guys. I wasn't going to somebody out into something that I love to do just to see, you know. And then a lot of guys I trained over the years, I had the gym there and had a ring in the back. And some guys just figured out on their own without me telling them. They could see how, you know, if I had three guys start at the same time, they would see how one guy would progress so much faster than they did, and they just got the drift and went on their way, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's that way. If you were doing those games, you had to have loved it to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Not only getting paid for it, but you love to do it. And the same with, teaching somebody to do what we did.
I was telling somebody yesterday, I actually went and picked up I had to go to the tag office yesterday, and I run into a lady. I used to umpire for her kids when they were little playing softball, and she was telling me her daughter was 30 now, and I didn't want to hear that. But
no, sir.
We were talking. I was telling somebody, I can remember getting up on Saturday morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, driving from my house in Mara, Georgia, to Cartersville, Georgia, meeting the guys at the Shoney's up there. We'd eat breakfast together. First game started at 8 o'clock, and I would call 12, 13, 14 games back to back to back. No break, just 14 straight games.
Oh, come on, Bobby.
Yes, sir. And we got $10 a game. At the end of the day, the guy I worked for would write me a check for $130, $140, however many I did. And, man, I thought I was getting rich. And I didn't realize I was killing myself.
When did you start that, Bobby?
Rocket Monroe was umpire. He started umpiring in Peachtree City, and he called me, and he said, look, this must have been about 1980. No, it was in the 70s. No, early 80s, I guess. Maybe 82, 83. It could have been a little earlier than that. He told me, he said, man, come down here and umpire with me. He said, they got a training class fixing to start. And he said, nobody down here watches wrestling. They don't know who we are. He said, this is airline pilots and stewardesses and bankers. And, you know, Peachtree City had a lot of money down there. And I said, well, okay. Went down there, went through the training. The first night me and him's on the field, everybody in the stands is whispering, that's a wrestler and a referee. I said, man, I thought these people didn't know us. Of course, found out everybody down there knew who we were.
Right.
But that's how I got started. And I just fell into it and loved it. I wound up, me and another guy actually owned the Umpiring Association, and we did all of South, everything south of I-20 in Atlanta, we control the umpires.
You're kidding.
And had a good time with it until my partner messed up and died on me, and when he died, I lost interest and I quit.
How long did you do it?
23 years.
So you was totally out of the game when you started that?
No. I was still, basically, I started when I was working in the office a lot, when I'd quit refereeing some. I did it for a while, and then I slacked off, and then I went back kind of full-time umpiring after I was working in the office and wasn't refereeing every night.
So you didn't do any football. You just did?
Just softball and baseball.
Did you ever do any high school games?
No, I went and took the test to do high school, and they changed the rule that year. And I know this ain't got nothing to do with wrestling, but that particular year they changed the rule in high school baseball in Georgia that stated if a base runner missed a base, you waited until the play was over and you called him out. They took the appeal process out of it. And they've since went back and changed it. You know, in Major League Baseball, if a guy misses first base, the pitcher has to take the ball, step off the rubber, tell the umpire he missed the base, throw it over there, step on the base, and they'll call him out. Well, they took that aspect out of it out and said, the umpire, when you see him miss it, you just wait till the play ends and you call him out. So I raised my hand and I said, I got a question. And they went, yeah. And I said, let me give you a scenario and you tell me what I should do. I said, I'm at a ball game, and I said, a kid hits a home run in the last inning to win the ball game, and he misses first base. I said, the kid touches home because the play's not over till he touches home. You're telling me while they're all jumping around and screaming and yelling and lifting him on their shoulders and toting him off the field, I'm going to say, time out. He missed first base. He's out. I said, that's what you're telling me I'm going to do? And they said, yeah. And I said, this is not for me. Really? Yeah. I said you're taking the onus away from the players and the coaches for having to police their own actions or watch the actions of the other team, and you're putting all the heat on me. So I never called the first high school game. And that rule lasted about 2 or 3 years, and they changed it back to the same as Major League. But, yeah, I never called the first high school game.
And you did it until when?
I quit, let's see, this is 2012. I quit, I guess, probably 2001, 2002. I loved it. I had a ball doing it. My mind still, it's like refereeing wrestling. My mind still tells me I can do it, but my knees say, no, you can't.
You more first base. You don't need your knees for that.
Yeah, but see, umpire in Little League in high school, you only use two umpires. That first base umpire's got to be able to run from first to second to third and keep up with the base runner. And I can tell you right now, I don't care how many shortcuts I take, I can't keep up with them no more.
You can borrow Jerry's ATV.
That's exactly what I'd have to have. Let me go back to Jerry's story. They was talking about Dick training him on the map. I remember Ted telling me this story. And me and Ted used to, when I was married to my first wife, her parents lived about, Ted lived there on, was it Snelling Drive?
That is correct.
Snelling Drive. Well, my in-laws lived on Susan Lane off of Floyd Road. I wasn't a mile from him as a crow flies. So a lot of times when I was down there, me and him would ride together. And we were talking one day, and I don't even know how it came up, but I remember him telling me the story about when Dick was training him. He said Dick would stand, and when they were finally in the ring, Dick would stand him up in a chair. And he said Dick would sit on the top rope and take both feet like he was drop kicking him and push him out of the chair, make him take a bump out of that chair. And he said this was going on, and they would do different things. And he said finally one day he asked Dick, he said, I know you've taught me how to do all of this stuff. He said, but how do I know when to do it? And he said, that's when Dick set him down and smartened him up to the business. And I remember Ted telling me this, and I thought how true this was, because there was a part of me that did the same thing. He said he was absolutely heartbroken because the mystery was gone. He said all of a sudden he knew what was going on. The mystery of it was gone.
Well, I know Dickie trained him at the arena, you know, there
yeah.
in Columbus. And I went down there one day, and they hadn't been working out but just a few times. So Dickie said, come on down there, you know, and, you know, we work out with him. So I got down there, and so I got Ted in the headlock, and I said, shoot me off, I'm going to hit you with a tackle. Well, he did. And when I hit him, Dickie said, whoa, whoa, whoa. He said, I ain't got that far with him yet. I nailed him.
He still talks about that today.
I'll never forget. I had a key to the sports arena, of course, when the office was over there, and there was a ring set up over there, and Rocket was training some guy. And I don't know who it was. And here again, you know, we've talked about it. Me and Rocket had been friends for years, and I had refereed hundreds of his matches. I'd never worked with him. He was over working with a guy one night, and he was trying to teach him a couple of things. And he said, Bobby, get in here with me, and let's do a couple of spots. And I went, okay. And he grabbed me in a headlock, and he said, shoot me in, I'll hit you with a tackle. So, now, you worked with him, Jerry, so you know
oh,
this.
Many times.
I thought a fire plug had run over me. He was solid as a truck.
He was. He really was.
And, I mean, he'd been out of the business at that point for a good time. He was, you know, he'd still work every once in a while, but he hit me, son, and I didn't. The air went one way, and I went the other way. I mean, I just. So I can imagine if you hit Ted and he wasn't expecting it, it was sort of like he was hoping somebody got the tag number.
But we, you know, Ted do things that I couldn't do, and I could do a few things he couldn't do. And I, you know, he could always do a kip up, and I never could do one. And I used to like throw head scissors, and kid didn't do head scissors, and it's just the way it was. You know, everybody can't be alike. And I always enjoyed working, you know, as a partner with him. We always thought, you know, and we got along great when it came to wrestling. There was no ego between us or nothing, you know. It just, we loved what we was doing. And but then, you know, it's just like anything else. You saw some guys over the years, you just wonder. I'm talking about in our day now, not today's realm of wrestling, but you just wonder, how in the world did they get in? But there was, you know, in our day, there was so many, I'll use the word great workers. I mean, it was just, you know, they were just, one guy I miss working with that Ted said was probably the smoothest guy he ever worked with, and that was Johnny Weaver. And I never had the pleasure. He said he was the timing. You know, everything's timing in that ring, and he said his timing was just absolutely, no matter what you do, he was there, you know.
You're talking about doing kip-ups. I got a friend of mine sent me some DVDs, and one of them is a series of Dory Funk Jr.'s matches, and one of them is from, had to be sometime 1969 or so, because he had just won the title. He won the title in January 69. And it's from Tampa TV, and he's working with Dick Steinborn. And Dick goes through a series, you know, they were doing the tackles and stuff, and every time they could take a tackle, he'd kip up. And I think that's probably the most I've ever seen of Dick working. Everything that everybody's ever said about him, him being a tremendous worker, was absolutely true. He's got, his coordination is just unbelievable.
His timing was unbelievable. But as far as smooth workers that I can say I ever had the pleasure with was Roberto Soto. He was like fluid. I mean, just unbelievable. He was fantastic. I never worked with his brother, but was you ever around his brother, Bobby?
Never met him. But I can tell you this, if anything bad ever happened, Roberto will tell you it was his brother.
Oh, well, please. I can vouch for that.
I'll tell you you mentioned Jannetty, and I've told you this before. I had the pleasure of working with Marty the first time he ever worked outside your gym. And it was an absolute night off.
Really?
It was a night off. I worked with him in Athens, Georgia. Charlie ran a show up there, and he booked me up there. I went up there under a hood, and, I worked with him that night, and he was scared to death. But I was probably as afraid of him as he was of me, because I knew it was, you know, he was real green, but it was an absolute night off.
And Marty was a fantastic amateur wrestler, too, but that makes me feel proud that you said that, because and let me tell you, he worked hard at it, I'm telling you. He really did. He worked hard at it.
I hate he didn't get the breaks that he probably should have got, because I feel like he's as good a worker as any of those guys that got the big push up in New York. But I watched some of those AWA matches when he was up there, and man, he had some great matches.
He did. But there was a lot of great brothers, George and Sandy Scott. I was partners with George when he first arrived in Georgia a time or two, but I never, you know, wrestled him or never wrestled Sandy, but I understand they were a real good team.
True brother. Saw them. I never was in the ring with them. I saw them work together a lot. I mean, I saw tape and seen them actually at the matches working, you know, as a team. But there again, you know, you're talking about you and Ted and how you guys, you know, you guys got along in the ring and you know, there's two guys that didn't get along, period.
Oh, look, when I went to Charlotte and George was the booker and Sandy took care of towns up in, I think, Virginia and up in through there, they didn't speak. They wouldn't even ride together.
When Sandy passed away, George didn't go to the funeral.
Do what? Huh? Are you kidding me?
That's what I was told.
No. You know, I never did hear what the deal was, but I really like Sandy. I don't know if you ever met him, either one of you ever met him.
Oh, yeah, he came to Mobile the last, what, 4 or 5 years of his life.
There wasn't a nicer guy, I think. He was just a super, super guy. He would always, we'd get in the town he was taking care of, and he'd tell Ted, and I says, I want y'all to do this tonight. Y'all ever done it? No, I said, but we can do it. And he'd always give us something that he'd want to see, and we'd do it, you know. And he was a great guy. He their problems was their problems, and what it was, I don't know, and never ask. And but they I understand, you know, together they were really good.
Well, yeah, they were part of that Hamilton, you know, group that came out of Hamilton.
How many guys come out of there, Mike?
And so how many brother tag teams? The Tolos brothers. Sharp brothers. Sharps were from there. Even though they weren't real brothers, they both came out the Jack Wentworth's gym in Hamilton with the Love brothers. Harper and Reginald Love were both from Hamilton. I mean, they're just so many guys that came out of there, and so many other tag teams. I was thinking the Kozaks, but they were from Vancouver. Gary and Nick were from Vancouver, so they started. They were actually both gymnasts, I think, before they got into the business.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think they were both gymnastics on high school and possibly even college level. I'm not sure.
I guess Nick Kozak. Nick's the only one I ever met.
I saw Nick work because he came into Mobile a couple times. I never got to see. Well, Jerry worked, and they worked in Mobile together in the early 60s, but that was before my time. Before I was not living in Mobile at that time. Nick came back in the mid 70s, and I saw him work quite a bit. But never got to see them as a team, but they were very good from what I understand. Both nice guys. They used to come to Mobile together. But Jerry hasn't been. He's had some health issues and hasn't been for the last few years. And Nick, I think he wasn't there this year. I think it's the first time he's missed in a while. But both of them are super guys.
Well, you talk about brothers now. You talk about you can take the funk. They were the most two opposite brothers I've ever been around. Totally opposite.
One was smooth as glass, and the other one was rough as a piece of broken glass.
That's about as good as you can put it.
And that broken glass, you never, ever knew what he was going to do, so you had to be careful.
Well, the reason for that, because he didn't know what he was going to do.
You must be talking about the Funk brother.
Yes. Goodness gracious.
I had the pleasure of working with both of them.
Did you ever work with the old man, Jerry?
Never did. I met him in Tampa. But I never saw him, wake him up, or he was there in 70. He was there with Dory. I don't even think he wrestled that night. I guess he's kind of in Eddie or something. But he's a very nice man. Very nice.
I saw him as a fan when I was a kid working in Atlanta. They used to come in with he would come in and team up with Terry and Dory against the Assassins and somebody. Or, you know, I've seen him here a few times. Yeah, Jerry, I know I've told this, or I guess I have. I was refereeing a match in Savannah with him and with Terry and Abdullah, and he had knocked Abdullah to the floor, and he was trying to go through the ropes, and he told me, he says, grab me around the waist and push me back. And I pushed him back about two steps, and the next thing I knew, my feet were straight up in the air, and I'd never took suplex in my life, but I was about to and didn't have no whole lot of choice in the matter. And when he did it, of course, back then, you know, that was a killer, so I just had to lay there. And when we got back to the dressing room, he said, man, that was smooth. He said, we're going to do that every night, and we did for a week.
So, whether you wanted to or not.
Whether I wanted to or not, yeah, but, you know.
You know, he's a big old boy now. I don't think he was.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
We got to Savannah early. You're talking about not knowing what he's going to do. We got to Savannah early one time. We used to fly in there, and the show was like at 3 o'clock. We'd get there like at 1. And I walked over to the Hilton right next door to the Civic Center there, and I went in a little old coffee shop, and Rock Hunter was sitting over in the corner, and I walked over and sat down with Rock, and we were talking. And while we're sitting there, the door opens up, and Dick Slater and Terry Funk and somebody else walks in. And there's a tray of Danish sitting there. Well, he just reaches down and takes a little old serving knife and cuts it in half and eats half of it and leaves the other half there. And he went over and sat down. And I remember Rock looking at me, and he goes, that's your world heavyweight champion right there. It represents all of us. And the hostess went over and got the other half and went over and sat on the table and told him, said, you've already paid for it. You might as well eat the other half. Yeah, he was a wild man. And still is.
How many True Brothers that you can remember, Mike, was in Mobile?
Oh, besides the Fields?
Right.
All four of the Welches came through there at one point or another. And then the second generation of the Welches, Jackie and Roy Lee worked there. Let me think. The Kozaks worked there. Let me think who else came through there. They were actual True Brothers. The Infernos, the version that was Rocky and Curtis Smith, were there. They did a couple shots there. The Gibson brothers, Reuben or Robert, as most people know him, broke in 77, which was the last year that the Fields promotion was in business, but they did work in there together. The two twin sons of Tony Gonzalez worked briefly under the mask of the Medics. Tony was kind of their manager. Their names were Oscar and George Gonzalez. I know I'm missing several. Oh, back now, if you go back as far as the 50s, the Donovans came in there, Red and Doug Donovan. I'm sure there was somebody else right in that time frame, too. There were several not True Brothers. The Greens came in there. The George and Chuck Grant came in. The second version of the Sharp Brothers, which was Mike Sharp and Ed Sharp, they came in. All these teams came in 1959. The Von Brauners, of course, they weren't True Brothers. We never got the version of the Von Brauners that were Doug and Red Donovan. They worked together starting in 66, and I think worked 2 years together as Kurt or was it Kurt or Carl? I don't remember which one Doug was, but Red Donovan was Eric Von Brauner. That's all I can think of. You and Ted both came through, but you never came through together. You came in at different times.
Right.
That's all I can think of at this point. I know there's others. I'll have a rush of them hit my head as soon as I get off the phone tonight as we end the show. But had a lot more pretend brothers than we did True Brothers. We had well, the Fargos, Jackie and Sonny came through together. and did a couple shots together. But of course, Don and Jackie were much bigger, and then Jackie also came in with Louis Tillett, and Tillett was working as Joey's partner.
I never knew that.
Yep. Yep.
You talking about somebody could work. That Louis Tillett was a worker, man.
Yeah. Even when he was older, because he came to work for Fuller in 79 when Fuller was trying to keep Knoxville alive after Garvin and all them walked out. He took the bulk of the crew that was in Mobile and sent up to Knoxville to try and stem off that hemorrhaging up there. But then he brought in Louis Tillett as the booker. And that's when Hogan and Austin Idol, Ox Baker, Sailor White, his Moondog Rex, they all came in. And Louis was working under the hood as the Gladiator. And he had to have been mid-50s by that time, and he was still a tremendous worker.
He could work.
I've always heard he was a good booker, but I'm never worked under him as a booker.
He was booking Florida when I started. He gave me my start.
Did he?
Yeah.
Sure, well, another one. He had another quote unquote brother prior to. Well, maybe after he was Joey Fargo. What the brother's name was. May have been Pierre Tillett or something like that, but was actually Terry Garvin. They worked as the Tillett brothers there for a while.
Bobby, you remember when Louis was working here? Was you in the business then?
No, when he was working here, I was just a fan then.
Okay.
But I worked with him. He came in as one of Ole. You know, Ole had a merry-go-round of assistants there for a while, and Louis came in as his assistant for a while.
I saw Louis and Dickie work one night in Columbus, and you talk about a match. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I'll tell you another brother team, and I never met one of them, but Bill Miller and Danny Miller. Never met Bill, but I've gotten to know Danny through Dromo, and what a super guy he is.
Bill, I worked with him in St. Louis. You talking about a big man? Good Lord. You know, he was a vet for the state of Ohio.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
nice practice there in Columbus. Yeah.
Super nice man. He was just a gentle giant. He was a super man.
Well, you know, there was another Miller brother before Danny joined. Well, they did some six-mans together when Danny first got started, but you've heard of Ed Miller, right?
Yes.
Of course, he wasn't a true brother. He was actually bigger than Bill was.
You're
taller
kidding.
Taller and heavier. No.
Huh.
I've got a couple matches from Buffalo. Has to be from late 50s, early 60s from Buffalo of Ed and Bill Miller working with the Kangaroos, the original version, Costello and Heffernan. You talk about two good tag team matches. Those two matches are tremendous.
Well, y'all have to remember the Kelly twins, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I do. Oh. I don't really know how you describe them.
Well, I was going to ask you, I don't know if you ever ridden in a car with them or anything.
No. I've just been around with them.
You missed out.
Golly. They were a strange pair.
They came to Mobile, so that's another pair of actual brothers that came to Mobile. And, of course, I just hit my head, Jerry's favorite pair of brothers, the McGuire twins.
You had to bring that up, didn't you? That's almost on the T-shirt level. That was cold-blooded, Mike Norris.
Oh.
Great McGuire twins. they came through Mobile a couple.
Well, I know how we can make a fortune.
What's that?
We can make a fortune with this. You know what a hover around is?
Yeah. Okay.
You know what it is, yeah. Bobby?
That little wheelchair thing.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know how we can make a fortune? We can get some videotape of the Mulkeys and then show all their highlights with the Steiners and the Road Warriors and so on, and then we can explain why today they need a hover round. Think about it now. You let that soak in. I've never seen two boys abused like that in my life.
Oh, geez. And developed a cult following, man. I mean, people still today talk about the Mulkeys on the internet.
I know they do.
They've got, I tell you, another set of brothers that we had here in Atlanta. Of course, they never got a push here, and one of them couldn't get a push because he wasn't that good. But Ken Timms and his brother Ed. They were coming in and being polite. They were enhancement talent on for the TV.
Well, there was another set of brothers, and you two don't remember them, but they around all that same time that we used to come over and do jobs. The Owen brothers, Bob and Lynn Owen.
I remember the names.
Bob used to, the first time I saw Bob, he was refereeing for Fuller. Around the same time I was breaking into the business. And then it was in good shape, you know. And then, but he gained a bunch of weight. He must have gained 100 pounds. And he was doing jobs on Atlanta TV. And he worked more often than Lynn did. It was kind of the same situation with Ken and Ed Timms. Ken did a lot more TV than Ed did. And it was the same way with Lynn and Bob. And do you remember the Dargon twins?
The who?
The Dargon twins.
That don't ring a bell.
I thought you said the Darvon twins. I said, that could be a lot of people I know.
The Dargon twins. They were friends of Tony Atlas's from the Carolinas. Two young black guys that were muscular. They weren't near as big as Tony, but they were in good shape, but they were just smaller. Think of he came along later on after we were all out of business. Or Jerry may have worked with him. You remember, what was his name, Rocky something or other, that did TV for WCW for a long time and never really got a push. I think he started around the time Holy was.
I know who you're talking about. I know exactly who you're talking about, but I can't think. I know who you're talking about.
I want to say Rocky Jones or something like that. But anyway, these guys were about the same. They were muscular, but they were on the small side. But they got in through Tony Atlas. And they built them up. You know, I guess Tony was, but nobody would use them, so they sent them to the Mobile. This was in 79 when Fuller didn't have a whole lot of people there working. The tag champions at that time were Affa and Sika. And they brought these two guys in and put them over and put the belts on them. Well, they got back to the dressing room and were complaining that Affa and Sika were too stiff with them. So that they held the belts for about 2 days and were gone. And I don't know what, their names were Leroy and Luther Dargon. And I don't know whatever became of Leroy, but Luther, every once in a while, would show up at Channel 17 to do jobs on TV.
I don't remember him.
Yep.
I don't know those names at all.
I think that was the only set of brothers, unless you got Ted Allen and Mike Jackson.
They went as the Miser Brothers.
Yeah. Oh, man. And then, of course, we all know the Monroes. But the only two of them were actually related. Sputz and Jet. And Jet didn't stay in the business very long. 2 or 3 years, I
Yeah, when Sputnik first came to Georgia, Jet was his manager. And then he wasn't here long, though.
Did the first rocket ever work in Atlanta that you guys remember?
Not that I know of.
And who was that?
Bill Fletcher.
I don't remember him at all.
Yeah, he was the original rocket. He came into Mobile in 63. He and Jet came in together. And they brought Sputnik in for a handful of tag matches. And then when they were all gone, and then the rocket that we all know, he first came in 66, but he wasn't called Rocket Monroe. He was called TNT Monroe. And he was around for about a month or so, and he got called. You know, Sputnik got wind that somebody was up there doing the Monroe gimmick that he didn't know, and he called up. Now this is a story of the Rocket, though. He called up to Rocky McGuire and said, "You tell that puke that's using my gimmick up there that if he doesn't quit using it, I'm gonna come up there and straighten him out." And Rocky told Rocky to call him back and tell him if he felt froggy, come on up there. So Sputnik evidently liked that, so he called Rocket and asked Rocket to come to Tampa. And they went in, they brought Rocket in Tampa, changed his name from TNT to Rocket. And that's how that was brought in. And then, of course, Gene Dundee later became Flash Monroe.
I'll give you, you may have heard this, Michael, I'll give you a funny story about that Tampa deal. They brought Rocket in there. And he was still green as a gourd. And he said they set up some workout sessions Sportatorium, whatever they call that place there, where the TV was, where the office was.
That's what it was called, Sportatorium.
Yeah. So they set some workout sessions, and it was the Von Bronners who was going to work out with Rocket and help him, you know, with the tag moves and stuff. And Sam Steamboat was there, and there was somebody else. And Rocket said that. But the Von Bronners just stiffened up on him and was eating his lunch. They was just rubbing his, you know, they wasn't teaching him nothing. And he said Steamboat got in the ring. And I forget which one he said. But said he took one of them Von Bronners and he stretched him out like you wouldn't believe. And he said, he told him when he got him stretched out, he said, "Now you need to work with a kid or you going to work with me." And said, from that moment on, they began to teach him how to work. And he said he learned more working out of that than he ever had, you know, anywhere else. And it wasn't too long after that they got there that they put the world tag team titles on Sputnik and Rocket. And I guess it was Luttrell told them, said, "I want you guys to go to Jacksonville early, and I want you to dress up in your," you know, they sent them out and had them buy some nice suits and things. And they were driving, I forget what kind of car Rocket said they had, but they put them in some kind of nice car and said, "I want y'all to go to Jacksonville early," and said, "We want you to go down to the black part of town and let Sputnik talk to these people and, you know, see if they'll come to the matches that night." So Rocket said they were driving, and they started up off toward and said the interstate wasn't finished. I said, "You're supposed to get off," but Sputnik told him, he said, "Go around the barricade and stay on the interstate." He said, "I've heard it's finished all the way to Jacksonville. They just ain't got it open yet. We'll just run on up there." And he said he was running about 100 miles an hour up there because there wasn't nothing on it. And he said all of a sudden the pavement ended. And he said the car went up in the air, and he said when it come down and settled, it landed in mud, and it said the car sank all the way to the doorknobs. Door handles. He said they had to crawl out through the window, walk through waist-deep mud. Forgot how far he said they walked. They wound up catching a bus to get on into Jacksonville. Of course, looking like that, they couldn't go do what they were supposed to. They went to the matches that night, worked, then had to catch a bus and ride all the way back to Tampa on a bus. Rocket said he walked into Luttrell's office with the World Tag Team belt and was just said, "I don't want to be the champion no more." He said, why? He said, well, I rode down here in a nice automobile. And he said, two days after I get here, he said, I'm wading through mud riding Greyhound. He said, I'd rather go back to the way it was.
Of course, I guess the biggest family in wrestling got to be the Welch family and all its branches. The Welch family,
yeah.
Of course, there was the four original brothers, and Roy's son Buddy. His sons, and Roy's daughter was married to Billy Golden, and was Jimmy Golden's mother. And then you've got Vaughn Welch, who is the sister of the four brothers, married Speedy Hatfield. So that brought Lee, Bobby, and Don into the group, and then all their kids that got in the business. Lester's kids, and Jack Welch had a daughter named Joanne Phillips who wrestled, and Herb Welch had a son named Doyle who wrestled. Doyle didn't have a very long career, though. With Lester's two kids were Lester Jr., who's known as Jackie, and Roy Lee, and on and on and on. And then you've got the grandkids of the Fields, Ricky Fields, Johnny Fields, which was Don's son. Don also had a brother-in-law named Buddy Carson who refereed, but he also wrestled both under that name and under the name of Marshall Fields. And Bobby's sons, Shane and Randy, both refereed. So I think I counted one time, there's 27 or 28 members that were active at one time or another in that family. And probably closely following them would be the Samoans and all of their relatives, because they've had a slew of kids who've gotten into the business within the last 20 years or so. Apple-seekers, kids and nephews and everything else.
Well, I guess the most tragic family of them all was the Von Erichs.
Von Erich, yeah. Yep.
Jeez. What a horrible waste that was.
You know, I don't know if this is true. I don't know who told it, where I heard it. But I heard those boys didn't want to be in the business. That's what I heard. And Fritz was insisting on them. I don't know if y'all ever heard that or not, but I heard
pretty much. Yeah. Well, from what I heard, the only one that really wanted to be in the business is the one that had the least talent and the least size, and that was Chris. But he was so small. I knew Mike never wanted to really be in it. He wanted to be a musician, from what I understand. I don't know about David, Terry, and Kevin. David, from what I've seen, was the most talented.
Yeah.
He was the most like Fritz. I think he would have been, had he not died, he would have been the biggest star out of all of them. I was only around Kevin a little bit the short time he came into Georgia.
And that was a very short time.
Out of all the ones that would have expired, he'd have been first.
He came into Georgia, and Barnett had me go with him and help him find an apartment because he had never been anywhere. He had never worked anywhere but Texas, and he came in there and had me, you know, help find him an apartment. Took him down on the south side where all the guys were living, and you know, helped him get set up a little bit as best, you know, just showing him around. And he lasted about 2 weeks, and he was gone back to Texas.
Really?
Yeah, he just left. Went home.
Just got home.
Now, I was told, which one was it that they put the belt on? Kerry? Gary.
Gary, yeah.
I was told that that kid had a natural charisma about him. I never met him, but they said he had a natural charisma about him. He was just one of those people that walked into an arena and people went crazy.
He looked the part now, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
He did have to look. But, and I'm not trying to speak ill of the deceased, but he just wasn't all there mental capacity wise from what I understand.
No, there was something. You know, he lost a son way before these guys.
Yeah, they were still in Buffalo. Yeah, they were living in a trailer park in Buffalo. That was Jack Jr. He was their first born. And I think David and Kevin were the only two of the others that were still alive at that time, or were alive at that time. The others hadn't been born yet.
Well, I don't know how old Kevin is, but he was in Vegas this year, and he looks 100 years old.
I saw a picture of him somewhere, and he don't look... Well, if you... Well,
he's been through a lot, I tell you.
He's done a lot of stuff in his time, and I don't know, it's sad. It's just sad. What's he doing, Bobby or Mike? Do y'all know what he's doing?
I have no idea.
Now, which one of them, was it Carrie's daughter that was working for Vince there for a while? Lacey? Is that her name? I think that was Carrie's daughter. I don't think she's not working for Vince anymore. I don't know if she's doing anything else. But.
I have no idea.
And, of course, you can't talk about large families without talking about the Hart family. And there again, that was another situation. Brett came into Atlanta and was getting a fairly decent push, 79 or 80, Bobby, and then he just kind of up and disappeared.
Who is that?
Brett? Yeah.
He came in, he was working first, second match. If I'm not mistaken, this was the first place he had ever been outside of working at home. I heard, and I don't really remember if this is the case or not, but I heard, and Ole told the story, and you know, it's Ole's viewpoint, but Ole said that he booked him in Augusta on a Monday night, and he didn't show up. And Ole said he fired him. Now, I don't remember. That could be the case, but I don't remember. But he wasn't here very long either. Quite understood as many stories as went around our business about that dungeon up there, about how he would get those guys down there and he had nails sticking out of the wall and he knew where they were and you didn't, and you know, I mean, just horror stories of things he did to guys down there. How guys could wind up getting suckered into going down there, that's just beyond me.
Is that what Benoit was trained?
Yeah.
Yes. Ted Allen told me, you know, he went up there. He said he went to Stu's house.
Right.
But he said he never, you know, he said they didn't try to get him down there. Randy Colley told me he went up there and had coffee with Stu, you know, at the kitchen table. But they said they never tried to, you know, and he wouldn't have win. He said he wouldn't have win anyway, but he never, I never tried that.
Benoit was one of the few that didn't marry into the family that was trained up there. Davy Boy Smith, of course, was a brother-in-law, married one of his sisters, and so did Jim Neidhart, and there was another guy, Biff Wellington, and I think he was married in the family, but I'm not sure. And then there was Ben Bassarab, who worked up there, and I think he was married into the family. There were a slew of them. When the in-laws and outlaws.
Well, we can't forget about the Briscoes.
Yeah. Well, Jerry's son now is, I think, in training down there with Florida Group. So that'll be second generation. Did Jack, you know, I don't even know. I don't remember if I read anything when he passed away. Did Jack ever have any kids?
No, I don't know that either, Mike. I really don't know.
I never heard if he did.
Neither. Well, here's a question for him. You. You talk about brother teams in Mobile. These weren't true brothers, but we have the Carson brothers. Of course, we all know Don Carson. Do you know who Ron Carson was?
Is that Murdoch?
Yep. Big Murdoch. Very early in his career. I think it may have been the very beginning of his career.
When was that, Mike?
67.
I think he started that early.
Yep. Yep.
That may explain a lot about Dickie's personality later in life if he hung out with Carson at that young age.
Well, Dick himself was a second generation. His stepfather, from what I understand. Well, I've heard it both ways. His father and the man was his father and his stepfather, or his stepfather, I don't know which. But Frankie Hill Murdoch was a big star in Texas in the 40s and 50s. And Dick's uncle was Farmer Jones. You guys remember being with him that traveled around with a razorback pig. That was Dick's uncle. And Killer Brooks is his first cousin.
Right.
Where are you going?
So they're family as well. And
don't worry about it.
Other thing, somebody else that's a member of a family that I'm hoping to have on in a few weeks is Freddie Curry. Of course, was the son of the legendary Bull Curry. But, working on getting Fred on the show as well.
I never met either one of them.
Did you ever see Bull Curry?
No. In person, no.
I've never even seen film of him. But from what I understand, he was a card.
I never met Fred either. Bobby, is David Sormentino still up in Marietta?
I don't know, Jerry. I do not know.
He was a nice kid.
Yeah. I had the privilege to work with him one night. Somebody didn't show up. I worked with him. I threw a hood on and worked with him. I was let's just say I was impressed as well as pressed when he scooped me up and put me over his head.
Wasn't he the world's strongest teenager at one time?
He may have been. He
held some kind of record.
I'd have voted for him. When I was on top, when I was about 8 feet in the air and his arms fully extended, me up at the top of him, and I knew there wasn't but one way down, I'd have voted for him.
Yeah, but his body shape changed. Back when he first came to Georgia, the first time I ever saw him, he looked identical to Bruno. He had the same body type. You know, he had a power lifter's body type, and then he leaned down and got more defined and everything. I think that's when he
sure
got on steroids.
He looked unbelievable.
And he totally changed his body style, but that's another sad situation. Now, from what I understand, the two of them don't speak. David and Bruno.
Is that right?
Whatever reason, yeah. I don't know.
He was up in Marietta for years, didn't he, Bobby?
Yeah, he was a personal trainer or something.
Yeah, I heard he was living here, but
you ought to go by and see if he still press you.
Well, I had news for you. If he impressed me now, he would impress me. Well, son, I'll be honest. I helped him get me up that night. If he picks me up now, he's going to be dead weight.
But he was always very nice. Very nice kid. That'd have been hard to follow in his dad's footsteps, wouldn't it?
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it was. I'm sure it was.
You know, did you ever work with him, or was you ever in a ring with him, Jerry? Bruno?
No, I only met him one time. I met him in St. Louis. I was on a double main event in St. Louis. It was me and Harley, and it was Murdoch and Bruno, and I met him. What a nice man. It's like you'd known him forever.
I never had a chance to meet him, but I saw him work one time, and I was disappointed. I was really looking for, you know, all the publicity and all the things I had heard. But, you know, of course, you know, New York worked a whole lot different than we worked down here. You know, I said for years, if you had sent Funk Briscoe to New York, they'd have killed that territory.
Mm-hmm.
Because they couldn't have followed it, because they didn't work that way up there.
Well, Dickie told me he was in Japan with Bruno.
Yeah.
And he watched him work in Japan. He told him after the match, he said, I didn't know you could work like that. He said, well, you know, in New York it's different. He gave them what they wanted. You know, every territory was different, you know.
Yeah. I remember, Bill, when territories changed, when Booker's changed.
Yes,
I remember
did.
Bill Howard was here. And Ernesto was booking, and we were working, and then Gary Hart came in as an assistant, and he brought Jardine in. And Jardine's deal was he liked to pound on people, you know, because he'd get them in there, especially the green guys on TV. I mean, he would just pound on these poor guys. And as that kind of thing takes place, people start working a little stiffer. They start working a little snugger. They start protecting themselves more. And I remember Bill Howard had been gone out for about 6 weeks, and he came back in, and the territory had changed. People were working different. And I remember the first night we were somewhere, and he locked up, and I forget who he was with, but he turned and looked at me. I was refereeing, and he went, "What happened since I left?" And I said, "We'll talk later." But I mean, it was, he immediately sensed it. He knew. And, you never, it just depended on where you were and what they wanted.
But I wasn't a Don Jardine fan. I know he's passed on, but I just wasn't a fan.
Well, me neither. I mean, I never had any problem with him, but just, he took advantage of people. And that's what
I'm talking about,
yeah,
Bobby.
He knew who he could do it with, and he knew who he better not do it to.
Thank you, sir. So, anyhow, that's what that was.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys that way.
You guys were talking about New York and how they worked up there. Roberto was telling me that he and Manny were working in the Carolinas together. And they brought Manny in, but Manny was working under a mask. And so they put him in a tag match with somebody, and Manny got in there and just blew up. Couldn't hardly work at all. Couldn't do any spots or anything. So he blamed it on the mask. He said, "I can't breathe with the mask on." So they let him take the mask off, and he got the next tag team match they had with him not working with the mask. He did the same thing. Got in there and blew up trying to work do mat work. And he said, after all those years working up there in New York, all he knew to do was punch and kick. And when he tried to wrestle, he blew up. So he set that into their opportunity in the Carolinas.
Well, that's a big difference now, that kicking and punching and getting out there and wrestling, you know, as we did. That's a big difference. It was a big difference.
But that's what that territory was built around. And, I mean, you had guys like Bruno and Morales and people like that, you know, they would start out with some simple stuff, arm drags and headlocks and stuff like that. But then, you know, before you know it, they're throwing punches and kicking just like the heel is. So that, the fans that grew up with there, that's what they love, and they would find Funk and Briscoe boring, working holes,
yes.
and you know that they find that boring. They're waiting on somebody to take a chair shot. And since that's the company that eventually took over the whole industry, that's what we see now. Unfortunately, the same formula that. The same formula that got Hogan over is the same formula that got Bruno over. You know, the wrestling business didn't change that much as far as what the WWF through WWF and WWE is. They've always done that. That's the style they've always had.
Hmm.
I think that's why so many people when Backlund was champion. Why so many people up there? I mean, he was popular there for a while, and he evidently drew money because they kept the belt on him for 5 years. But you hear people now talk about him, about how boring he was, how he had no personality. But I tell you what, he was an impressive athlete.
Yes, he was.
In fact, he was on the show Monday night. They brought him out. They've got this guy on there that's something Slater. He's Slater or something like that. And the whole angle with him is he gets in the ring and talks about how great he is, then they bring out somebody from the past to come in there and beat him. So far he's wrestled Vader, Slaughter, I think, Sid Vicious, and last week it was Backlund.
Did you see it?
No, I didn't see it. I just heard about it. Match lasted about 2 minutes, and back on beating with the chicken, cross-faced chicken wing, or whatever it was that he used. But Bobby told the story when he first came into Georgia before they ever put the belt on him. That what was it? He would do Bobby the stair steps.
No, he would do sit-ups. He'd do sit-ups.
I saw him do the leg raises one night for about an hour and a half.
Oh yeah, he would get two tables, and he would lay on one table, and he would hook his feet under the other table, and he would do sit-ups. And we found out that he had an addiction to popcorn. So he's working Ronnie Garvin one night in Athens, and Garvin comes through the you know how the dressing rooms, how one side was right by the concession stand, the heel side, and then
right.
You come through into the babyface there at the old J&J. Garvin comes through the babyface, or comes over to the door and hollers at me, and he's got a bag of popcorn about the size of a grocery sack. And he says, go in there and start feeding it to him. And when he's in there doing setups, I went over there and I was just standing there beside his head, and every time he'd lay back, I'd drop popcorn in his mouth. And he was like a kid. As long as you'd feed it to him, he'd eat it, man. So as long as he was sitting there, I just kept feeding him. And we got him so full of popcorn, Garvin, it's the only time I ever seen him blow up, but Garvin blew him up that night. Garvin laid on him and rode him, and he just, I mean, he ate so much popcorn he couldn't breathe.
That boy was in shape now.
Yes, he
strong.
Was.
Good Lord.
Yeah, he was a nice guy. Yeah, I always wondered why they put that title on him. So he was so different from everything that they'd ever had up there. He was more NWA championship material than WWF material, as far as that goes.
Wasn't Vince Sr. still in charge when they put that title on him?
Oh, yes, sir.
See, Vince Sr. liked wrestlers.
Well, he never had one on top.
Well, may not. He had to put up there what Drew, but he knew he was. I had the pleasure to meet him and talk to him, and he was just a very astute businessman.
I never heard one word bad about him ever from anybody. I'm talking about not a soul.
No, he was a super nice guy, and he came in. They used to have an NWA meeting here. They would meet here at the airport sometimes in Atlanta because it was so easy to get in and out of here. And I was out there one day when he was there, and I had a chance to sit down and talk to him a little bit. And he just, what a nice guy. I often wonder, and I don't know. You don't know what people think, but I often wondered if he's just rolling over to his grave with what's going on today.
I would think so for what happened.
Yeah, me too.
To his friends, you know, like I said, I've never heard no other promoter or anybody say one bad word about that man.
No.
I'm sure he was disappointed. I mean, when's enough, you know?
Yeah. That's true. True.
And I'm sure he was very wealthy.
Oh, yeah. Well.
Yeah, he was close to Eddie Grant. In fact, he lived down in Florida, even though, you know, his territory was in the Northeast. He made his home in Florida. Of course, he knew Eddie Graham from the Graham's time there in New York, and they were the top drawing card for him. That was in the Capitol days prior to it becoming the WWF. And the Grahams were the main thing, and along with Rocca in Madison Square Garden for a couple of years. He was familiar with Eddie Graham. Of course, he lived the WWF up until, I guess, just before Vince Sr. bought his dad out. They were actually members of the NWA. They had to split at the beginning with Rogers and everything, but then somewhere along the fold, they joined back up with the NWA.
They always kept their membership. When Vince Sr. was alive, they always kept their membership in the NWA active.
Did they?
He was always a member. He just, he ran his own deal up there.
But he was a smart businessman.
Yeah. The bylaws of the NWA, all they said was, it was all the legal mumbo-jumbo of the incorporation. It was supposedly a conglomeration of promoters that would work together for the promotion and the betterment of the business, okay? They had all the legal terminology in there to say it wasn't a monopoly. But the only bylaw that they really had that they enforced was you could not have a champion using the NWA banner that said that they were more important or bigger than the NWA World Heavyweight Champion. That's why Vince always went under WWWF or whatever he called his thing up there. He never referred. I remember one time Backlund had the title in New York. Ole was booking. It was probably one of the first times Ole was actually booking here. Might have been when him and Gene was together. They booked Backlund on the card at the Omni in Atlanta and booked him against, it was either Briscoe or Flair. And Ole booked it as title against title. And I remember Vince calling Barnett and screaming and jumping, not screaming at him, but just screaming about the fact that you couldn't book title against title. Now, if you're a wrestling fan, I think you can figure out you can't have one guy have both titles. And they wound up going an hour in the Omni that night. They won a draw. Both guys kept their own title. But that was, that was one of the things they fussed about. And to give you an example of how strong the NWA promoters were about that bylaw, when we did the when Watts did the deal, the Champion of Champions Cup here in Atlanta, they put a give it to Wrestling 2, and he was the Champion of Champions because he beat Harley and lost it on a fluke. I forget how he set the deal up. But the NWA convened a meeting. The executive board convened a meeting, and they actually reprimanded Barnett as the promoter of record for Georgia Championship Wrestling because he allowed them to present a product that made it more important than the World Heavyweight Championship.
Well, Bobby, was one of the bylaws of the thing that about staying out of other people's territories?
No. That was not in writing. No. See, if you did that, you would have been running a you would have been a monopoly.
Right.
You know, you can't. Technically, what it was just you were that was an unspoken rule. Okay. You know, Barnett would not have ran a show in Bob Geigel's territory if he thought he could have drawn $20 million. He would not have done it.
Right.
I mean, it was just an unspoken thing that went on. I used to have copies of all that stuff, but I wouldn't have any idea if I even still got it where it would be. But the NWA, they just, you know, there was nothing in writing that said they basically said you could promote anywhere you wanted to. But never in the whole time that I worked for Jim Barnett, and especially after I got into that back office where I was involved in some of the things going on, the NWA was constantly, I mean, never a day when somebody wasn't suing them, trying to bust them up, saying they were running a monopoly. Because back then, and you know, when you broke in and when I was just getting started and up through the time I got out, if you worked, you were going to work at an NWA office, or you were going to work for Vince, or you were going to work for Vern, or you wasn't going to work, or it was going to be considered outlaw.
Right.
So. But it was by doing that and protecting the business in that respect, it made that championship mean something. I mean, Jerry, you probably can attest to this, and I know Michael can. When I was a kid going to the matches, I was a fan. I mean, man, when that world champion was coming to town, I was going to be there.
That's right.
Because I honestly thought, well, you know, this local hometown hero can beat this guy.
It was called Mystique, Bobby.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And, you know, when they would, you know, and the champions were so good that even when they beat the guy that was the local hero, they beat him in such a way that you felt like, well, if they hadn't have made that one mistake.
There you go. There's always that doubt.
Hadn't have made that one mistake. Or if they had just did this instead of that. I mean, the greatest finish I think I've ever seen in a match in my life, and I, you know, I didn't know what a finish was then, but Tim Woods, the Friday night after he got that finger bit off on Wednesday night, worked with Gene Kaninsky for the title in Atlanta, Georgia. I had cut grass and saved my money and went up there, and I was fortunate enough to be able to get a ticket on the second row at ringside because I was by myself. It was just me. And there was a single seat there, and I was that close to the ring. And Garibaldi's refereeing, and I didn't know Garibaldi was a booker. I didn't know what a booker was. All I knew was wrestling. Mr. Wrestling had been pushed so much in Atlanta, I figured he could beat anybody. And the finish was Kaninsky after Tim beat him. They probably did 10 or 12 false finishes where Tim almost beat him. And finally, Kaninsky went after that finger. He went after the finger. and he bent it back, and he bent it back, and you know, back in the day, if you remember, referees, one of the rules, you could get four fingers and you could separate them. You could pull the thumb, but you could not separate the fingers. That was a rule. Okay, he would get all four fingers, keeping it legal, and he worked on that finger that had been bit off. And everybody in Atlanta knew it had been bit off because they ran an article in the paper about it. And Garibaldi stopped the match. He stopped the match. Tim Woods never gave up. And I can see it just as clear sitting here, and I don't know how many years ago that's been. Garibaldi, when he went over and handed the belt to Kaminsky, and he went to raise his hand, he really didn't raise it. He sort of just threw it up in the air like he was disgusted. And he turned, and Tim Woods is saying, "I didn't quit, I didn't quit." And that the next night on TV, I remember the interviews. Tim says, "I didn't give up. I didn't give up. The referee stopped the match," and I don't blame him. He did what he thought was right, but, you know, I mean, what a great, you know. Maybe I'm just crazy that I remember that from that many years ago, but that is etched in my mind is how good that was.
That's because it was good.
How simple it is, and it made sense.
It was good. That's what
I was going to say. It was common sense. It was common sense. Man, if I'm the world champion and I know you got a weak link and you're fixing to beat me, what am I going to do? I'm going to go with your weak link. I don't care if you got your finger bit off.
How many world title matches did you work, Jerry?
Did I?
Yeah.
Just to give you a ballpark figure, probably 10.
I know you worked with Harley quite a bit. What other did you work with Punk, Terry?
Worked with Briscoe a lot, Terry. Worked with Flair. I guess that was it, the guys that actually had the belt at the time. Worked with guys that had it, like O'Connor, Ez. If you want to count Baba, who else? But I'll give the NWA credit. They always had champions that meant something, you know.
Out of all those matches that you had, how many of them went 60 minutes? How many Broadway did you have?
Oh, ooh. Broadway with Terry, Jack, Harley. That was it on that, I'm sure. I guess doing our Harley was the easiest of them all.
You had the
No, I never held that.
Oh, well, I don't think I saw what you held the Missouri State Champ.
No, I never did.
Bobby, we're lucky to be able to be associated with Gary Oates. You know that?
Do what?
I said we're lucky to be able to be associated with Gary Oates.
You know what? Tell you what, guys, I was blessed. Blessed one more time and do it one more time.
Yeah.
I still miss it. I have people ask me, I'm not every day, but do I miss it? And the answer is yes.
Me too.
It's kind of like trying to get flypaper off of you. You just can't shake it, you know?
I think Harley, I heard Harley describe it one time, and I think he pretty well summed it up. He said, once you have been under that spotlight, he said, there's no other place in the world like it.
Well, I tell people, it wasn't an ego thing. It was just something you love to do.
That's exactly right.
I love to do it.
You know, that's what's always has amazed me about the guys who develop, you know, drug problems and drinking problems and all that stuff. You would think, or maybe it was because of that, because they were still chasing that thrill, you know, after they left the arena. They're looking for something to maintain that that thrill. I mean, I was nothing more than a job guy. It was still a thrill for me to work in places. I mean, it was a thrill for me to work in Expo Hall, where I had grown up watching matches, you know, as a young person. Same thing working at Pensacola, and that was a thrill for me. I never got to work in the Omni in Atlanta, but I worked in Chattanooga at that building, you know, the memorial auditorium there a couple times, and that was a very well-known. If you followed as a wrestling fan, you heard of the memorial auditorium in Chattanooga. You knew the history of the matches that went on there. That was just a thrill for me. Whether I was in the opening match, which is 98.9% of my career, that's what I was. And, you know, I got beaten 6 or 7 minutes or whatever, but it was still a thrill to me just to be part of it. I mean,
well, you know, I was never a chemical man or an alcohol man. I got my high off about what I did. And
that may
sound stupid to a lot of people, but, I can remember, you've mentioned matches I had, so-and-so, I don't more remember that than a man in the moon. And I'm sure the both of you remember matches that you had years ago, just like it was last night.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I guess you'll take that to your grave with you, you know?
Yeah.
I wasn't searching for anything but that, you know? You know, I saw guys, oh my gosh, come in the dressing room so buzzed up and smoked up and filled up, and I checked my head. I was a tight guy. I know when I was promoting, I didn't put up with that. I don't care who you were. You know, that, you know, you could kill somebody out there or break somebody's neck or you know, whatever. You know, there's a time and place for everything. That wasn't the time or place. You know, that was, to me, it was my job. It's how I made my living, and I respected it.
Yeah, that always made me more nervous going to Atlanta TV, driving over there on Saturday morning, hoping I didn't hear you working with Buzz Sawyer.
I used to see him there, and I would shake my head, how on God's green earth could holy let that man get in a ring and represent what we did. I never understood that. I'm sorry. I know he's dead and gone too, but my gosh.
Half the time he didn't even know where he was. Now, you know good and well he wasn't going to protect who he was in the ring with. And I think, luckily, that I would never have to face that situation. But had they come to me and said, you're working with Buzz Sawyer, I'd have just packed my bag.
I don't blame you.
There was no way. I mean, he was dangerous. He was absolutely dangerous. And Rich wasn't, several times, Rich wasn't much better.
Please.
He was popular with fans and all that stuff, but he was sometimes so out of his head that he wasn't going to protect you either.
That was an aspect of our business that people's never been in it. I mean, I don't know that they can really appreciate this, but you know, you mentioned, you couldn't protect your opponent, couldn't protect you. You know, we went out there and basically gave our bodies to the guy we were in the ring with every night.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we had, there had to be a certain amount of trust there. And if there wasn't, then you wasn't going to have a good match because you were going to be afraid. I mean, you know, not that you're, well, maybe you were a little bit afraid of the guy, but not that you was afraid of the guy, but, you know, hey, you got
to
work tomorrow night
and
the next night and the next night. And, you know, back then, it ain't like now where if you get a hangnail, you take 3 weeks off or go to rehab or whatever. Back then, if you missed a shot, you lost your spot and you didn't have a job.
Well, here's another prime example, that running back from Georgia, that's from Columbus. Cromwell or whatever.
Crowell.
Can you believe that? Can you believe that? Can you actually believe that?
Gave him the world on a shoestring, and he didn't know how to tie it.
I shake my head. When I heard that, I'm thinking, here's a guy from Columbus, Georgia, probably. I know where he went to high school, and you have a gift that God has given you, and you take it and throw it out the window. I mean, what would he have a gun in his car for? And then smell of marijuana in there. I mean, what are you thinking?
He wasn't.
I mean,
I heard yesterday he went from the University of Georgia in the Southeastern Conference in one of the top programs in the country, and next year he's going to play at Middle Podunk State over in Alabama somewhere.
And I heard him talking about it. They said he, after this year, he could have more than likely gone to the NFL.
Sure he could have.
Now, you go figure that. Millions of dollars. I shake my head. I'm sorry. But we saw it in our game. And yes, while promoters put up with it, throwing that money. You know, money does a lot of things to a lot of people. But I listen, if you got somebody like that, I don't care how much money somebody would draw you. If you can't depend on them, to me, they're not worth a quarter. You don't know what kind of shape they're going to be in. Are they going to be there or what? I don't know. Maybe I looked at it all wrong. I don't know.
Yes, well, a lot of people have, and again, I'm not trying to speak ill of the dead, but a lot of people have elevated Bruiser Brody up to this, you know, icon-like status. And he was one of the world's worst about, you know, stiff from a promoter. If he didn't like what was going on, you know, he was no-show. Or he was one of the...
And where else could he have made the money he made doing what?
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, I never was around him much. And the time I was around him, he seemed pretty decent, like a decent guy. He quiet and took to himself. But, you know, I was just that day he put that dude in a wheelchair and rolled him in front of Gordon Sutherland. I thought to myself, well, there's another one I'll cross off my list. I don't know what it is up there.
Well, the day he did that, as soon as he left the TV station, he went and got on an airplane and left. He didn't make his shot. You know, I mean, he just, I don't know, these guys, you know, going back, and there again, we're not speaking ill of the dead, we're stating absolute facts. Buzz Sawyer, you know, I refereed a few of his matches. I was in a ring with him a little bit, but I dealt with him more on the office side because I wrote the paychecks. Well, payday in Atlanta was on Tuesdays. And it was, you know, the checks were supposed to be ready at 11 o'clock on Tuesday morning. I'd get everything ready, and Barnett would come in and sign them, and then, you know, the guys could come get them. He would be calling the office at 7:30, quarter to 8, when I would walk in, wanting to know if his check was ready. And would absolutely get hot at me because it wasn't ready. And I said, hey, I can't sign it. I got to wait until Jim gets here. And, you know, I think his grandmother died about once every 6 months because he would want to get paid on Monday because he needed the money because he had to go to Tampa because his grandmother had died. I mean, and this was the same grandmother that died 6 months ago and then last year. And, I mean, it was constantly something. But it was the fact that he had that monkey on his back, son. And I don't know if he's putting it up his nose or smoking it or whatever he was doing. But he was just, you know... He was just way out there. And, you know, what a guy did on his own time and away from the business, that was his business. I didn't, you know, not that I liked it, but I didn't have nothing to do with that. But I'm like you, Jerry. When these guys come in the dressing room and you can look in their eyes and tell nobody's home, that's scary.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, last time I saw Buzz Sawyer was... It wasn't the last time I worked TDS, but it was the last time he was at that I worked there. He was sitting in the corner of one of those cubicles. He was half dressed. He had his tights on and one boot. And he was sitting there grabbing and pulling that little bit of hair he had left on his head, and he was screaming. It was something. I don't know what it was he was seeing, but he was screaming. Lord have mercy. Maybe it's a good thing I just do my job and go home.
Oh.
I could imagine getting in a car with him for a 4-hour trip to save my life.
Oh, no. No.
Even if I was driving, I wouldn't want him riding in the car. Oh, man. I know
I know Jerry's talked about he rode by himself a lot. You know, I was very careful who I rode with.
Oh, please.
I mean, I figured out real early in life. I mean, I was not an alcoholic. I've never smoked in my life. I've never used drugs in my life. And I made my mind up. I wasn't going to jail because of somebody else's stupidity if I knew they were stupid. So these guys, if it was even in the only time I ever got caught in that trap was with Billy Spears, God love him. I rode with Billy Spears one time somewhere, and Billy decided to have a little herbal medication on the way down the road, and next thing I know, we're bumping people from behind at 80 miles an hour in the left lane because they won't get out of the way. So that was my one and only trip with him. But, you know, I mean, you had to be careful. I mean, that was just...
Sure did.
Oh, geez. And, you know, it's really amazing that no more guys went to jail than what they did for some of the stuff they did.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ooh. That's true. Mm-mm-mm. And then you also have to think half those guys, or probably three-quarters of those guys that were in that condition, were probably also carrying guns, too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, please.
The Wild West, man.
You know, it never bothered me for a guy to drink a 6-pack or 12-pack or whatever it was. You know, I made a million miles with John Walker, and when we come out of the building wherever we were, the first stop was going to be a store, and he was going to get a 6-pack of Miller Lights, and he drove and he drank his little Miller Lights, and I threw the bottles at mailboxes on the other side. I mean, it was just a
you didn't do that.
No. Never bothered me for him to do that because I knew he could hold it and he was not going to get drunk. I knew that. But there was some of these guys, man, a 6-pack wouldn't do. They had to have a case for a 100-mile trip.
Thank you.
And that was just, ooh. They used to laugh at me and Rocket because we'd stop and get a quart of buttermilk and a bag of Fritos.
What squares y'all were.
Well, I'm sure Rocket had his taste of the other side by riding with Sputnik all those years.
Oh, jeez.
I can't imagine that either.
No, that'd been a nightmare for me.
Oh, jeez. Rocket said he had to drive all the time. He said because he couldn't trust Sputnik. He didn't know what he was going to do. And he said there was a million times they pulled over on us. He'd get so mad at him, he'd pull over on the side of the road and get out and want to fight with him in the grass. And Sputnik would say, "Come on, get in the car and let's go."
I don't know if I want to take a road trip with him, but if I had to pick four people out that I'd love to sit in a room and just listen to the stories, it'd be Don Fargo, Sputnik Monroe, Jerry Grant, and Mario Glanza. Which they'd probably all four kill each other before the night was over. Oh, man. Well, guys, we are down to... 5-minute mark here, and we'll go ahead and wrap it up. Anything you guys got to promote or talk about, or
no?
Any birthdays or anybody or anything like that?
No.
I got nothing to promote.
Well, if you happen to find yourself on Long Island,
the next 3 weeks. Circus will be all over the place. We're in Massapequa right now. We'll be in Santa Maritis next week, Southampton part of next week, Farmingdale, Bayshore, and let me think, I'm forgetting one, Greenport, and then Oceanside. Anybody that's listening that's on Long Island, you got plenty of chances to go see Gold Brother Circus. If you have to pick a town, pick Oceanside, because that's mine, and I want some big crowds.
Well, Mike, if any of those shows happen and you Cannon man can't make it, just give me a call. No.
Yeah.
I know Bobby will show up for that.
Yes, sir. If you get him in the Cannon, I'll come watch. When do you head back south, Mike? Do you know yet?
I leave here 3 weeks from today. Where I'm going, I have no clue. I don't know where I'm going. Here we've got the show when it leaves here to go back into New Jersey, but I probably won't be going there. I'm thinking I'm either coming to somewhere in the Carolinas or maybe Georgia. I'm not even sure what all we're doing in Georgia this year. I know we're doing Hampton, but other than that, I don't know for sure what else we're doing in Georgia.
Did they not get to shopping center in Conyers?
No, the guy I think wanted too much money. He wanted like $10,000 to rent that little burnout shopping center with nothing in it.
Okay.
I think he'd be happy to get $2,000 since there's nothing in it. The shopping center's empty.
I heard that.
But not even sure we're doing Watkinsville this year, which is up around Athens.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what we're. Those things are all still.
Are you still doing the racetrack in Hampton?
Hampton is, I think, is a sure thing.
Okay.
But I don't know whether I'll be there or where I'll be going. But,
okay.
But, I like it up here, but I'm ready to be headed south.
I understand. I understand.
Well, guys, we will get together next Thursday and do this again. And this has been fun. And I'm glad
I've enjoyed this.
Have the three of us together again.
Y'all have a great week. And I'll see y'all next week, guys.
Yeah. All right, guys. Have a good week.
Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Listening to the Crodcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.